Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a medication compliance conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Medication compliance means taking your medications as directed, not too much, not too little, but just right. I recall my death diary research at the peak of the opioid prescription epidemic. Doctors told me that if patients took their medications as they were directed, they wouldn't die. I went on a mission to find out if that was really true. I studied all 254 people in San Diego County in 2013 who died of a medication. And I noticed that only 16.5% of the people who died were compliant. I couldn't talk to the people who died and ask them, hey, were you really taking your medications like you were supposed to? Instead, I had to use data. To be compliant for research purposes, patients had to meet the following criteria: die of the same medication that was prescribed, had no illicit drugs or alcohol in their system when they died, and were not doctor shopping, meaning they did not use 4 different pharmacies plus 4 different doctors within 12 months. 4, 4, 12. Most people who died of medications were not following the rules of prescribing according to this definition. Only 16.5%, a very small minority, met this definition. I noticed that there were people who were double dipping when they died. They were considered compliant by the 4 doctor, 4 pharmacy, 4, 4, 12 definition of doctor shopping, but they were getting their prescriptions every month from 2 different pharmacies and 2 different doctors, hence double dipping. I also learned that chronic medication users were nearly 70% of everyone who died of a medication and consumed 96% of all the prescriptions. Chronic users were defined as taking the same opioid prescription for 3 months or more, and that was a high-risk population for death. Most people who died, died of a cocktail of medications. But if a single drug was responsible on the death report, it was most likely to be methadone. Methadone is a long-acting opioid, which makes it more dangerous than short-acting opioids. One dose of naloxone after a methadone overdose will wake you up. But you can overdose again within a few hours because the methadone lasts so long. I keep people in the hospital for 24 hours after a methadone overdose. We no longer have an opioid prescription crisis anymore. That, thank goodness, is gone. We solved that problem. However, the issue of safe prescriptions, medication diversion, and medication adherence and compliance is important. I was recently a speaker at a conference on fentanyl, and Dr. Sue approached me to converse after my talk. Dr. Sue is an anesthesiologist in Whittier, California. He specializes in pain management and had a front row seat to the opioid prescription epidemic. He's now the CEO of iPill Dispenser, a new medtech startup. To learn more about medication compliance and the iPill, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Dr. Sue on March 7th, 2025. Dr. John Sue, welcome to High Truths.
Hi, Dr. Lev. Thank you very much. Glad to participate.
Yes, we met at a conference in San Diego and chatted, and you told me about your invention, and I thought that's really interesting. I bet our High Truth audience would like to hear about it and learn about it. But let's start with your path to medicine. I tend to have a lot of doctors on the show, but I guess because I am one, that I'm attracted to that. So, but tell us, why did you become a doctor, and how did that get you to inventing things?
It's been a long trip. So being Asian, I had a tiger mom, and you know, being a American, I tried to rebel against that, but eventually fell into medicine after I didn't do well at a couple other things. And then went through medicine and chose anesthesia because it fit my personality.
You have to tell me that. What is an anesthesiologist's personality? And keep in mind, I have two daughters who have anesthesiology, who are going to anesthesia. So I want to see if it matches.
Okay. The reason I chose medicine is because I wanted to do something that fit my personality. And my personality is I like to do things that I can find that I can satisfy my judgment. Meaning I choose something, I try something, and I'm right. So I feel like I can be right often. And that makes me happy. It makes me feel like I'm doing something effective. And it just so happens that with anesthesia, you choose something and you get immediate result right away. You don't have to wait. And like if you did internal medicine, you have to wait months to see the effect of the medication that you're prescribing or the effect of your treatment. But in anesthesia, you give something, and like, let's say we give propofol to put a patient to sleep. And 30 seconds later, they're asleep. So you know you chose the right drug, and you did something to make your judgment satisfied.
Right. And then you got to wake them up.
Yeah, and that's the part that is more relief than satisfaction of judgment, because when they do wake up and they wake up quickly and your turnaround times are very quick, that means it fits my whole theme in life. I like to do things, I like to get it done, and I like to finish it so I can move on to something else.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know if that, I have to ask my daughter if that's what, I don't know if that's the reason that they would get. And you work at Inner Community Hospital, is that right?
Yeah, Presbyterian Inner Community Hospital. I've kind of stepped away from medicine to try to help more people because, not to preach, and I'll do this very quickly, but became baptized, went to the River Jordan in Israel to get baptized, and I came back, and I didn't know what it meant to be baptized, and I thought that, you know, I could do something with my skills to help more people than the people I help in my daily practice.
Yeah, well, that's great. So, and by the way, I've floated down the Jordan River several times. I was born in Israel, so that's great. And so you had a spiritual experience that got you to reframe your life.
That, plus I had a near-death experience early, and then a couple of years ago, in 2022, I had another near-death experience. It has to do with my heart. My heart rate went down to 10 after an MI. And my blood pressure was 30, and I'm looking at death. And because I used to do cardiothoracic anesthesia, and I know a heart rate of 10 is pretty close to dying. And so I think God's given me a second chance, and I'm going to take advantage of it and try to help as many people before I die so I can really do something beyond my own life to help people.
Right. And so, yeah, God gave you a second chance because you have more to give.
I think so. I don't know exactly, but I think I do. I'm doing the best I can.
That's great. That's very inspirational. Thank you for sharing that. But so now you're working on what I met you doing is working on the eye pill. What is that?
So let me give you a little bit of a background. I ended up near the end of my practice doing chronic pain and addiction medicine. And I found that 75% of my patients, and it turns out 75% of all patients, don't take their medications as prescribed. We doctors prescribe, but it's hard for us to follow up to make sure patients take their medications as directed. Patients get a vial with a child-resistant cap, and when they open the cap, they can take one pill or take the whole bottle. They can divert, abuse, and overdose and die. So I created a remote medication monitoring device. The easiest way to understand it is to hold up your cell phone and to do a face print to get security clearance so you can open an app, let's say your bank app. And then that connects to a bank ATM. for pills that I send to patients home. The reason I'm doing that is because there's many barriers to care. One of the barriers is, really transportation. Getting a patient with opioid use disorder to my clinic or to the pharmacy is very difficult. Transportation, childcare, getting insurance, those are barriers to care. And I remove those so that patients with opioid use disorder can get care. There's only 10% of patients, or 11%, who actually get care. And that's horrendous because 100,000 people die, and it costs our country $2.7 billion. So I'm hoping that through what my experience, my life experiences, and through my belief that I can actually save money and save lives in the future beyond my existence.
Yeah. So that's how that's the motivation is improving medication compliance, especially for people with opiate use disorder. So you created this app and a device, is that right?
Yes. The app is very interesting because it uses your face print to make sure only the prescription holder gets access to pills at only the prescribed dose and time. And we're using AI technology to take a picture of the person's face and then capture their vital signs. FDA class 2 approval for heart rate, and we're going after respiratory rate now. Now, this company is not mine. It's another company that I am collaborating with. So that allows me to monitor pills and the patient, which is basically holistic care. When you treat someone with opioid use disorder or OUD, you have to treat the mind, the body, and you have to make sure that you can treat the whole patient.
That's great. You know what? You made a little video about the device, and maybe we could share it with the audience.
iPill helps patients get their medications so they can get better. After getting a prescription from your healthcare provider, the iPill with pills already inside are delivered directly to your home every 30 days. Get your smartphone and download our app. Take a picture of your license and face, then hit dispense. It's pretty easy. Next, take a video of yourself taking the medication. iPill makes certain that only you can get your medications at the prescribed dose and time. iPill securely stores medications to prevent misuse, diversion, and accidental overdose of others in the house. Our revolutionary new dispenser also detects missed daily doses of medications and reminds patients to take the missed dose. Family, friends, and caregivers can also be notified to help keep patients accountable. If someone tries to dispense more doses or tamper with the unit, the pills are quickly dissolved and rendered useless. iPill is with our patients every step of the way on the road to recovery.
All right, well, that was a nice video. I like the woman with the British accent. So let's go through it a little bit. So if I take my phone, I get a face verification that this is me, and now that allows me to open the pill box. Is that right?
Yes, there's a encrypted Bluetooth connection that handshakes with the device. The device is right here that I'm showing you, and this is the phone that connects to it. There's a face print, collect vital signs, connect directly to this. And this device holds 30, 60, 90 pills that can dispense at once a day, twice a day, three times a day, or four times a day. And the most important part of this is if someone tries to break into it, it actually destroys the tablets in the dispenser.
So I can't, there's a bunch of drugs in there, I can go steal it. But I won't be able to open it. It'll destroy the drugs. I can't bang it open and try to get some oxys.
Yeah. If you try to bang it open, it will actually send a liquid through that actually coats everything. So the pills become non-absorbable.
And it's toxic. So it has charcoal in it, right? And then it'll immediately, if you try to tamper with it or try to steal it and get drugs out of it, it'll send charcoal and deactivate all the medicines. That's clever.
Yeah, and that's really the most, that's one of the most unique parts of this, because there are a myriad of dispensers out there, but no dispenser actually takes the pills and controls them in this fashion. So, you know, if people try to take more than one, they can't. And really what we're trying to do is make sure you can make sure the patient is taking their pills as prescribed. Because that makes my life easier. If I know patients are taking the pills and I know it's working or not working, I can actually individualize care and make my patients better.
Yeah, interesting. So who would give you this iPill dispenser? Would you get that from your doctor, your pharmacy?
Yeah, well, it could be all of the above, but what I do to reduce the issue of opioids being lost or stolen, because, you know, every year there are 6.7 million opioids lost in the system, according to the DEA. So I actually mail it directly from the pharmacy to the patient in all 50 states. That way we can reduce the barriers to care. Because, you know, let's say a veteran who lives in the United States who fought for us bravely, they live in a rural part of the United States, and it takes them 2 hours by car or bus to get to a clinic. And there's not very many clinics in the United States to treat veterans.
They don't have
to do that. They can get the medications directly to their homes, which I send directly to their home. They have to sign for it with an adult signature, and that saves them time.
So you're acting also as a pharmacy, not just a device manufacturer.
Yeah, we have a collaboration with three pharmacies. They have an open, closed, and repackaging license in all 50 states. In fact, you know, we can work with specialty pharma too, because, you know, many patients with the HIV or cancer or even transplants, they can get these medications. Interesting story. You know, I used to do the anesthesia for heart transplants, and many of these patients, they get a heart transplant. They, you know, from the childhood, from infant age. And then they go 10 years and they forget that they had a transplant because they feel so good. Then they forget to take their medicine, go into rejection, and need another transplant or die. So we can make sure that these patients take their anti-rejection drug to reduce the incidence of rejection.
Now, that would be just the app part, right? Like a reminder? Is it kind of like an alarm reminder? Like, hey, time to take my medicines.
It is, but, you know, you got to make sure these patients take the medications, because part of the issue is, you know, we prescribe medications, but we can't see patients taking the medication. So using the app, we can record the patient taking medications, or we can put a small NFC chip on each individual pill so that when the pill hits the stomach, the pH of one sends a signal to the app that I can collect to say that the patient did take the pill, or the patient went into the environment of a pH of one.
Interesting. Now, when would that be so important to, like, you know, I don't know, people would say, like, invade my privacy, like, did I remember to take my blood pressure medicine today? Maybe I forgot. Do you really need that degree of scrutiny on compliance? I could think of maybe tuberculosis patients, like before you let them out in the public and infect the community with tuberculosis, you want maybe that compliance or something, or...
Well, that's a great question, because, you know, surrounding opioid use disorder, OUD, there's a lot of stigma. That's why 90% of people who use drugs use it alone in their bedroom and die in their own bedroom. So, you know, what I do is, instead of having the patient show this device around, they can leave it at home, you know, take their medications at home, and we quietly text the patient's family, friends, and the caregiver to remind them to take it. Because, you know, when you have a team help the patient, they do better. And really, for security reasons, you know, we leave all the private information on the phone. The only thing that we upload into the cloud is the fact that the patient took it or didn't take it. We don't have a specific name or anything like that. We use a handshake encrypted identification that's de-encrypted at the patient's, at the physician's EMR.
Wait, so if you, I don't know, this is a stretch, but this, it reminds me of a little bit of Gene Hackman, who was found dead, and through his pacemaker, you could tell that he was dead 9 days ago, but that means for 9 days, nobody got notification. The doctor never got notified. Nobody acted upon the fact that he was in asystole with no heartbeat for 9 days. So how, this is a loose association, but like, okay, you didn't take your medications for so many days. Somebody gets an alert?
Yeah. I mean, an important part of it is if a tree falls and no one hears it, did the tree actually fall? If you don't take your medications, we will know that within the first couple of hours. And we can notify family, friends, and the caregiver to help them take their medications, and they still don't take it. You know, the increasing intensity of care by the physician can be made such that we can bring them in and help them, remind them to take their medications. Because if they don't take their medications and they tell me they take it, and I'm prescribing the same level of care, the patient's not going to get any better.
Yeah. But there's a, first of all, I don't know how much doctors want to monitor that, right? I mean, they'll monitor it when you come to the appointment, you're back at the doctor's office in whatever, a month, 6 months, a year, and they review everything and say, oh, you didn't take your medicines for all this time. You know, that's reasonable to do it. But real time, even when things are critical, so, for example, my husband has a loop recorder, and he had a little blip of fast heart rate. It was probably like 2 weeks before he was really notified, like, hey, we just noticed this, and, you know, we should check it out. It's not even something as important as really life and death, your heart rate. Things aren't so instant as in information. Do you envision a different type of system?
Well, I think this system works because the studies support it. When you have family, friends, and the caregiver actually reaching out to patients, it actually makes them feel like they're being cared for. And plus, yeah. I had a patient who used this as a, this device is already FDA class one registered. I gave it to a patient in my own practice, and I noticed that he didn't take it that day. And I just happened to text him, and he said he had a handful of drugs in his hand, and he was actually going to commit suicide.
Oh.
And he said the fact that I texted him to ask him why he didn't take his medicine made him feel like he was being cared for.
Somebody was paying attention. Somebody cared.
Yeah, and actually, he said it saved his life, and he's now an opioid use disorder counselor at one of our local churches.
Oh, that's beautiful. You know, I think that's the point you're making. I think that your caregivers, in a way, care more than the doctor, right? And that's maybe a different system, that alert goes to people who care. If you're in NA, can go to your sponsor or other people to create a circle around you. So I like that. It's a different notification than, you know, to the cardiologist with the loop recorder.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that I learned, you know, when you ask people why they want to be a doctor, you ask me very early on, and many people say they want to help people. Well, actually, who really helps people are the nurses. The doctors direct care, but the nurses actually give care. Because they're closer, they have more touches with the patient, and family, friends, like exactly what you say, have more touches with the patient than the physician.
Yeah. And you mentioned this is FDA approved. Explain that.
So there's a process, class one, class two, class three. If you look at one of these vials, this is a class one device. The vial has, you know, can't kill anyone. This is just a big vial.
Okay, so that's it? Just one little door and a closed vial? All the secrets are on the inside?
That's it.
Interesting. What does it look like on the inside?
Oh, that's the secret.
That's a secret?
The makers of the device for me are Foxconn, the makers of the iPhone. Actually making it. And what's interesting is that in medicine, insurance companies make it difficult for us to treat patients with opioid use disorder. Well, they make it hard for us to treat patients in general, because the reimbursement doesn't match the amount of time and the amount of nurses that we employ, everything that we do. And so I'm avoiding insurance by sending the device to jail to pay for the device from opioid litigation settlement funds and OUD clinic, who we revenue share with remote patient monitoring and remote therapeutic monitoring code, and we send it to the VA. We're going to be sending it to the VA. We're already on the VA portal, which means that soon the providers of care to veterans can now order it in bulk and send it to all the brave Americans, all the brave men and women who fought for us, who are injured or who have pain, who have opioid use disorder, can be treated.
Yeah, I could see the use for that. So, and I'm wondering what kind of reaction I'm getting from the opioid clinics, because I think that they have you have to come in every day to get methadone, or if you're getting your medications from the methadone clinic, you have to come in every day until you build some accountability, trust, and then you can go home with even up to a month's supply. And we saw that during COVID. But then that presents a huge risk in the studies that I've done on medication deaths. The number one drug that kills you by itself without other drugs is methadone, because it has such a long half-life. So that is, and I would see like everyone who gets a month's supply of methadone would have that added accountability and safety through a device like this.
Yeah, it would. And if you can picture a bank ATM in your house, except it's smaller and it looks like this, the device weighed a whole 30 pills, and not only will it prevent you from taking more pills than prescribed, but it prevents other people in the home from getting to it. At the end of 30 days, it destroys any unused pill. We send this device to the patient's home every 30 days. Therefore, we're solving the problem of the patient having to go into the methadone clinic. And that's a win-win situation for everyone involved.
Right.
Doesn't have to go to the methadone clinic every day. And therefore, they can work and have a good, meaningful employment. The methadone clinic can therefore see many more patients. They can use telehealth to see their patient. And really, there's methadone is a schedule two to medication, and there's about 4,000 overdose deaths a year. Suboxone is a class three medication, and there's about 2,000 deaths a year. So we can handle both schedule two and schedule three medications, and really we can do any medication that requires some sort of remote medication adherence monitoring.
Right, or when there's an abuse potential, right?
Yeah, and when you have abuse potential, now with the face print, you can make sure it's the prescription holder only that gets the drug only at the prescribed dose and time.
Yeah. So would this be for people with chronic pain?
It could be, but, when you treat patients with chronic pain, they have activities of daily life that require certain doses. So in my chronic pain practice, I have a background of a longer-acting opioid plus a shorter-acting opioid to help match the activities of daily life, meaning that, there are certain times when they do something and they need more medication because...
So the PRN, so the device is not for people who need PRN as needed medications. This is only if you have a strict regimen of dosing.
Yeah, as a class one device, we have to have a strict non-change regimen. And we're going after a class two designation in which we can use this as a PRN. But it, as a PRN device medication, you can take maximum of 4 to 6 pills or 1 or 2 pills, depending on the prescription and the medication. That's a class two device. And again, we're in the process of doing that.
So explain the class devices again.
So class one is something that it has very minimal chance of causing death. Class two, and this is very...
Oh, so this is the same schedule as medications, but for a device?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean? Okay, we get it. So it's class,
Yeah, non-implantable, very low chance of death. Like a pacemaker would be class three.
Oh, wait a second. I'm sorry. I think I just messed it up for our audience. It's not like the schedule of medications, like where class one is illegal, like heroin, right? Devices are a little different.
Yeah. So as far as medications, class one is illicit and highly addictive, and the risk-benefit ratio is higher risk than benefit. Class two is essentially addictive, but there's a lower risk versus benefit. High risk, but high benefit. Class three is lower risk, higher benefit, and class four and five are very low risk of addiction, but very high benefit. For a class one medical device, non-implantable, and also very low risk of causing death. Class two is higher risk of causing death, non-implantable. Three is usually implantable, high risk of failure, and that could cause death.
Okay, so but that what you just outlined is the class, the DEA schedule class of medications. I'm asking for devices. Is it the same?
Yes, class three. Yes. Okay. DEA is medications, FDA is medications. FDA actually does the regulatory enforcement of medical devices as well.
Yeah. I think this is a great thing for, like you were saying, remote areas who need medications. I think there's a lot of problems with benzodiazepines too. Or, you know, we in our study, we found that 50% of everyone who died was on opioid plus benzo together. So that combination is a red flag. So anybody who needs that together. When I studied the death diaries, I saw various cheating schemes. And it comes to mind that people would go like they're supposed to one doctor and they'd get their medicine, but then they would double dip and go to another doctor and get the same thing. I see people with two devices. There has to be like there's probably some control to make sure that you don't have that as well.
Yeah, and this device actually is the cure, so to speak, to cures what we have in California to prevent doctor shopping and to prevent patients from going to budget doctors, because most patients, 97% of patients, have a smartphone in the United States, and they only have one phone. You can only use one phone to connect to the dispenser. So that means that if you have to have it, you know, and that allows me to control the dispenser and dispensing, because I have to have a face print, and that face print I put into the phone and I put a number to it, and I can only send one device per face at this time, per medication. So that means that if I have multiple medications like the benzodiazepine and the opioid, I have to send two medications.
Yeah, I just had another thought, was we worked with health plans because people who are doctor shopper are at risk of dying. I mean, like we could predict that you have a high risk of death based on your prescribing patterns, that if a health plan identifies these patients, then they put those patients on a iPill kind of care plan.
Yeah, but, you know, in those studies, and I've been a part of several different studies trying to identify patients with OUD, very difficult. They have these scales, they have surveys, they have genetic testing for trying to figure out patients with OUD, and very difficult. Hard. You know, it's very hard. In fact, you know, I love telling stories, so another story. Very difficult. You know, I was late to clinic one day, and I saw my patients going from car to car. And there were like eight patients in the parking lot going from car, going to the next car, going to the next car. What they were doing was they were taking their bottles and counting their pills and making sure the pill count was correct. Because when I bring them back into clinic, I count the number of pills to make sure they took their pills as directed.
Yeah.
People have some left over. And I stopped doing pill counts that day because I know the pill counts were therefore very inaccurate.
Oh, yeah. That's another cheating skills. Yeah. Wait, no.
I bought the iPill for that day. I, you know, another story. I went to a bank ATM to get money so I could eat dinner. And I said, why not do this for pills at home?
Yeah. That's great. So did you, this was your idea? You thought of this? Hey, I got going money to get an ATM. I could do the same thing with these medications.
Yeah, I'm a programmer. I have a 3D printer at home. So I went to my garage to tinker and built a very crude one that dispensed 30 pills. And then, you know, knew my limitations and got some professionals involved to design and build it. You know, Foxconn makes the iPhone. It's a great device. So I asked them to build this. And, you know, this is something that can save a lot of money and save a lot of lives, a lot of American lives.
Wow. How long have you been working on this?
4 years. I've been in practice for 30 plus years. And so, you know, it took me 26 years to figure out that all the medications I prescribed, 75% of my patients weren't taking them properly.
Now, you went from being a doctor, a clinician, an anesthesiologist. I relate to that. And you were reborn. And now, but you were reborn professionally. You went into business. And take us behind the scenes. Like, what did you have to do besides, you know, invent this in your garage, find someone else who could do it better? How do you get, you know, you have to find investors or cost or talking? Take us a little bit about what that's like.
Well, first of all, it's not a process for the timid. You know, it's very difficult. You have regulatory issues dealing with the FDA. You have enforcement issues dealing with the DEA. Then you have to raise money because doctors aren't paid very much. And so you have to raise money and talk to investors, and that's a different speak completely. Then you have to talk to programmers, engineers, manufacturers. Then you have to talk to marketing, business people, reimbursement people. You know, there's a lot of things that you have to deal with. It's not just as simple as me taking care of patients. I wish it was, because I wish it would be that, you know, as a doctor, my specialty is taking care of patients, and I wish I could just do that. Because, you know, I'm not the best at doing all these other things. That's why I have a good team.
Yeah, yeah. So you created a team, yeah, and that in itself is a lot of investing. You mentioned something about when we were talking in San Diego that I didn't know about. That you said there was a difference between types of investors in funding a project.
Oh, yeah. If you're going to talk about financials, there's these different ways to invest. Seed investors are people who want to invest in something that makes them feel good, the satisfaction and the judgment. But that's also the point of highest risk, because usually you don't have contracts, you're not making money, it's just an idea. So we've raised money at the seed level, and now we're beginning to raise money at the round A level, meaning that we are beginning to get contracts. We are beginning to sell to jails who are repaying us through opioid litigation settlement funds. There's billions of dollars sitting in those committees, and they can't figure out a way to get people treated safely and to get a way to fight the opioid epidemic. And they think that the iPill is something good, because 65% of jail detainees wait OUD. And when they get out, wait going to follow them, wait to take care of them.
So how does this work? When you leave the jail, you get one of these devices?
Yes, we get one of these devices, and we drive that detainee who gets released early on parole to get a drug treatment or opioid use treatment. We send them to a opioid use disorder clinic to make sure they get treatment. You know, we try to make sure that they are able to get access with telehealth and then to see a physician, social worker, anything that can help them get housing, reduce barriers to care, anything that will help them re-enter society. You know, the toughest part is with veterans. You know, there's 208 clinics in the United States for veterans, and they treat 6,500 patients. But through our conflicts of war, there's 418,000 veterans who can't get treatment. And what they're doing is they're going to the VA parking lot. They're shooting themselves in the VA parking lot.
I can't believe that happens because they can get access outside the VA, right? They should be able to go outside the VA to get care. That should never happen.
That's the problem is many of these places that have care can't give care because they aren't funded properly. The need is too high for the amount of people that they can take. You know, we have 1 million doctors in the United States. We have 5,000 pain docs in the United States. We have 3,000 addiction medicine physicians in the United States
treating
probably 27 million people who could use care. Right now,
2.7
million people are in treatment, but close to 9 million people need treatment.
Well, that's what the primary care family practice doctors should be able to handle the average person with the opiate use disorder, just like they do the average diabetes or high blood pressure. And then the difficult cases should go to the specialist because it's not that difficult to, you know, in as far as medical care and things that you've learned how to do to treat.
And the problem is, you know, with the patients and with family practice, when you see patients, you have 30 patients you have to see in the morning. That's 4 hours. You know, you have basically 8 minutes to see a patient. And that's really hard because, you know, I talk a lot. I like to listen to my patients. And, you know, the nurses are always knocking on the door saying, Dr. Sue, hurry up, hurry up. Hard.
Yeah, it was hard.
So anything else that, you know, you want everybody to know about the iPill?
We're really launching to market soon. We're coming out, we're doing a commercial study now, and we should be out in the market probably in July, August, September, in that time frame. And what we want to do is use the time to really get patients with opioid use disorder treated. Because we can save, let's say we save 50% of patients, that's 50,000 patients, and $2.7 trillion divided by two. That's the amount of money we're trying to save at this point.
So inside this iPill, you would say when you talk about opiate use disorder, so you think that the Suboxone, buprenorphine would be in there, not just the opioid pills that we've been talking about?
We make sure that we can show that we can save lives and save money, then we can go to insurance to get it paid for. So then we can therefore then go to opioids, benzodiazepines, stimulants, tranquilizers, and sedatives.
Right. Anything that is where compliance is, you know, really critical or life and death, like you're saying. Yeah. That's very great. So I wish you luck on that. And then any other drug development that you're working on or any other projects?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. We're at the Cleveland Clinic right now. We have an opioid plus a respiratory stimulant combination pill. So that means that we're building a safer opioid that prevents death by preventing respiratory depression and high levels of intake of the drug. We cause a fight-or-flight response, which prevents people from wanting to take it again. We're supported graciously by a NIDA NIH grant. I also have a third project going.
Wait, before you go, I think you called it Quivi Pharma?
Yeah, Quivi Pharma. He is who in France, and Vive is live in.
Ah, I totally botched that up. Quivi. So, and that is hydrocodone, which is an opioid, plus doxepram.
Yes.
The stimulant. Not doxepin, which is a tricyclic antidepressant, and doxepram, which is a medication, like, as a physician, I don't really prescribe.
Well, in anesthesia, one of the issues we have to do is we have to make sure we can move cases through. So surgeons don't want to wait because that's wasted time for them. So doxepram is a 50-year-old drug that's already FDA approved that increases the speed in which patients wake up from anesthesia. In fact, that prompted the third company that I started, in which I combine Narcan or naloxone with the respiratory stimulant, because now with the advent of fentanyl, which is flooding our country, if higher doses of fentanyl are needed to counteract, the higher doses of Narcan are needed to counteract the higher doses of fentanyl. And many doctors started with 4, but they're finding they have to use 8, 10, or even 12 milligrams of Narcan, when you can add in doxepram, alone can stimulate respiration in absence of Narcan. And adding the two drugs, you have two ways to stimulate respiration. The effect of the opioid and increasing stimulation of the brain to start breathing on its own spontaneously.
And that one's called Fentaviv. Am I saying that right?
Yeah. Fentaviv, and you're going to live. The DOD and BARDA, we have spoken initially about it.
That's interesting. So what is the half-life of doxepram? Because the problem with it depends which opioid you use, right? So for example, if somebody overdosed on methadone and I give them Narcan, they'll wake up, but the methadone can last 24 hours. And I've learned the hard way that if somebody overdosed on methadone, they need to be admitted to the hospital for 24 hours because they need that monitoring. One dose of naloxone or even 2 or 8 or whatever right away won't work because methadone lasts so much longer.
And that's true. And so fentanyl lasts, when you give it IV or oral, if you give it IV, it lasts for maybe 20, 30 minutes. Doxepram lasts for probably 4 hours. IV, it lasts for about 20 or 30 minutes as well. The important part is that the armed forces have an injectable Narcan 10 milligram that they push through the FDA. That's why they're talking to me, is because for an injectable, that it lasts longer. So putting together the Narcan with the respiratory stimulant really improves the recovery and resuscitation of a patient with opioid-induced respiratory depression.
Yeah. And the fact that Department of Defense, our military, is talking to you means that they are really considering how fentanyl can be weaponized, is a weapon of mass destruction, not just killing the, 200 plus people a day that die now from fentanyl in the current way, but also for a drone that with aerosolized fentanyl going over the stadium and be able to respond to that.
Absolutely true. So a couple of things to let you know. I read in the news today that the Florida law enforcement and the DEA captured a few kilos of fentanyl. A few kilos of fentanyl can kill about 1 million people. And we know that fentanyl or carfentanil can be used as a weapon of mass destruction, because you look at the Chechen rebels who overtook a Moscow theater, and there were 800 people in that theater, and they aerosolized probably carfentanil, we don't know for sure. 400 of those people died because they couldn't get Narcan in to those patients and those theater goers soon enough.
Yep. Yeah, it's already been used as a weapon of mass destruction. It's just, it already is. So that's something else. We're trying to get fentanyl declare a weapon of mass destruction to get after the source.
Yeah, and if you look at the drug enforcement people in Arizona mentioned the fact that, a lot of medications come through Arizona, and they call Arizona the fentanyl funnel.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, San Diego and Arizona compete for, for the drug trafficking centers. But this is very enlightening. It was a pleasure meeting you, learning about all the good work you're doing, and I wish you the best of success.
Thank you very much. I really need it.
Our nation needs it. Good job.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction. where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit DFAF.org and ISAIC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.